More at lmsupply.com. Slight chance for snow overnight, lows in the upper 20s, and about a 40% chance of snow tomorrow.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Houghton. Coming up on As It Happens.
Battle-weary, 1,000 days into Russia's war on Ukraine, I'll speak with a surgeon in Kyiv who I last spoke to 2 years ago. He'll tell us how he and his patients are doing as this war drags on and as Russia announces an ominous new nuclear doctrine.
And Flight After Flight Risk, a Facebook page dedicated to ludicrous and dangerous staircases, has been on a real upward spiral in terms of fans. The man who created that page tells us what gives him such a sense and descents of purpose.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
It's a minute after 6 o'clock. There's more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Beltrami Electric, a Touchstone Energy cooperative with a mission to provide safe, affordable, reliable electric service. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. And we thank Clacko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, who are continuing their Sunday Fun Day events each weekend. The last Sunday of the month is open mic with Diddy Wish, where the stage opens up to the community's art, whether it be music, comedy, or anything else. More info at clackobrewing.com. We're going to take a listen now to our album of the week. It is Baltic Street Hotel by Sophie Gault. Gault is a Nashville-based singer-songwriter releasing her second album. It recalls the early days of Americana, when mixing rock and country was far less common than it is today. It was produced by Ray Kennedy, known for his work with Lucinda Williams, Steve Earle, and Patty Griffin, all clear inspirations for Gault's sound. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear this evening is called Poet in a Buick from Sophie Gault.
Lane.
From our album of the week, Baltic Street Hotel by Sophie Gault, that song's called Poet in a Buick. You can read more about the album at kaxc.org. I'm Jennifer Barr, coming up at 7 o'clock. DJ Dang, your host for On the River. Right now, more from As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
1,000 days in, Ukraine hits another bleak milestone since the Russian invasion, and as new uncertainties emerge in the conflict, we'll reconnect with a surgeon in Kyiv who has grown unhappily familiar with the effects of war.
Anticlimactic. One of the world's top development economists tells us the COP climate negotiation process needs total reform, starting with the petropowers who've been playing host.
Their minds are on her mind. For 3 years, New Brunswickers have been desperate to find out what might be causing a mysterious brain disease. Premier Susan Holt says getting answers is a priority for her new government.
A break from brake lights. Manhattan has approved a plan to implement a toll to reduce congestion. An advocate says that will slowly drive much-needed change.
Watch your steps. A man in Kansas tells us why he created a Facebook page for people to share the terrifying staircases they've stumbled across or down, and the kinds of things users are railing against.
And in the lab of luxury, an Australian company prepares to launch lab-grown foie gras. Prepared from a slurry of quail cells, just the way you like it. Banking on a so far non-existent high-end market for science-made meat. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that works flawlessly. One 1,000 days ago today, Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine after years of escalating tension. And ever since, the tension has just continued to escalate. After getting the go-ahead from the U.S., Ukraine has struck deep inside Russia with American-made weapons for the first time. That move was answered by Russian President Vladimir Putin, who announced he had lowered his nation's bar for using nuclear weapons. Early in the conflict, we spoke with surgeon Mikhail Zagrychuk, who described the scene when his colleagues were forced to complete a heart transplant on a 14-year-old boy after the hospital lost power during a rocket attack.
We never experienced such a situation before, and I don't wish anybody to experience the same stuff. But they could manage a light from mobile phones, from the lights on our forehead, special ones, and they managed to finish this surgery. And fortunately, this child survived and surgery was successful. But first couple of seconds, of course, because nobody was ready for it, and it was very, very, very horrible.
That was Dr. Mikhail Zagrychuk back in 2022. We reached him again today in Kyiv.
Doctor, hearing that conversation, how has the war affected your work as a doctor since that conversation?
It's affected a lot, to be honest. We have every day our soldiers and civilian people who wounded during Russian bomb attack, and also we hear every day and every night alarms, bombs around institute, around another hospitals, but we get used to it, unfortunately, almost 3 years.
What does getting used to it look and feel like at this point?
To be honest, I don't even know how to comment this. Mm-hmm. I thought before the war started, I thought it is impossible to get used to this situation, but this is a life, you know. If every day, every morning you're waking up because of bombs around your house, you just get used to it, and life is continuing. It's never stopped. It's horrible. We are dreaming about stopping this war, but what can we do for now?
Did you expect, you know, in those early days, in that first year, did you expect that nearly 3 years down the line, 1,000 days later, this would still be happening?
Of course not. Nobody expect this. We hope it maximum months or two. But it's not true that it's 1,000 days. It is not true. Our war starts since 2014. Yeah. And since 2014, when we lost Crimea, when we lost Mariupol, Donetsk, Lugansk, there was a war every day. And our soldiers were killed every day. And of course, this is last 1,000 days. It's more horrible days in Ukrainian history. And we didn't expect that it will be so long. And more than that, I don't and we don't know how long it will continue yet.
That not knowing, the weariness, do you think Ukrainians have had enough? I mean, is it at a point, if we talk about a potential peace process, that people in Ukraine would accept losing territory if it meant ending this war?
It's very, very difficult questions with no answer. Because, you know, if every day, 3 years, day from day to day, we hearing bomb attack, we losing people, and you know, the only one desire you want is just to stop the war. So I think a lot of people will be ready to accept losing some territories, but this is only my own opinion. From other side, I think it should be a referendum where we will have a chance to decide, but I don't know how to do this in during the war. So it's very difficult questions without a correct answer, I think.
Support from the United States has been key, obviously, for your country and for its military. As you watch what is unfolding in the United States, the political situation, the election, the re-election of Donald Trump, how are you feeling about what it might mean for your country and the prospect of peace?
Well, first of all, I would like to say thank you to Canadian people as well, because your country and your people helping us a lot. But of course, United States is a leader in this process, and we believe that Donald Trump will stop this war. At least he promised to do this for 24 hours even before his inauguration. It's not happens yet, because it was impossible. But you know, as I've told before, if every day you feel the bombs around your house, you can believe in anything, because the only one desire all each Ukrainian has is to stop the war. So I hope Americans and especially Donald Trump's team will do it and stop this war.
Do you think his relationship, or what we see to be his relationship, what they've said between him and Vladimir Putin, will help your country or hurt your country?
I don't know, to be honest. I hope it will help, but we never know how it will be in real life. It's not about his, I think it's not about their relationships. I think it's about personal country politics and it's very, very, very difficult political decision has to be made.
You've likely heard Vladimir Putin's announcement that he's changed Russia's nuclear doctrine. What do you make of that? Do you see that is signaling an increased willingness to use nuclear weapons? Does that feel like a real threat?
I think so. Unfortunately, I think this guy can make this and he can start the nuclear war. And I hope all democratic world also will understand that Russians are crazy and they're not joking. It has to be the strong signal that we need more from all the world, more support. And all international institutions has to be scared, because this guy can start the war. And of course we are afraid, because if he will start the nuclear war, it will be in Ukrainian city, in Ukrainian territories, and of course we want to live, we don't want to die, because one crazy man wants to start the nuclear war.
Doctor, I appreciate your time once again. Please take care.
Okay, thank you very much. And Thank you very much for your support.
Dr. Mikhail Zagrychuk is a transplant surgeon with the Kyiv Heart Institute. We reached him in Kyiv. New Brunswick's new Liberal government delivered its throne speech today, and as much as she's already got on her plate, incoming Premier Susan Holt has made something clear. There will be a scientific review into the mystery brain disease plaguing dozens and potentially hundreds of people in her province. 3 years ago, the previous Progressive Conservative government launched an investigation after 48 patients, mostly on the Acadian Peninsula and in the Moncton region, showed unexplained neurological decline. Their symptoms ranged from memory loss to muscle spasms and hallucinations. And then things got more complicated. The province convened an oversight committee that quickly concluded most patients suffered from known diseases, like Alzheimer's. But a Moncton neurologist disagreed, suggesting something else, potentially in the environment, might be to blame. The federal government offered help, the province declined, and patients and their families were left in the lurch. We reached New Brunswick Premier Susan Holt in Fredericton.
Premier Holt, you have promised this scientific review, and to put a finer point on it, a transparent scientific review, as you've said. What might that change for these patients and their families? That what will they get that they did not receive or find out in previous investigations?
Well, I think patients right now are feeling like no one cares and no one is listening to them. We care. We want to know what's making them sick, and we want to get to the bottom of this. And we don't want to do so behind closed doors, because when you don't have the information you need as a patient, you assume the worst, and that can be really scary. And so we want to make sure that every step in the scientific investigation is clear and communicated to patients and their families, so that they can be reassured that people are taking this seriously and work is happening to try to get answers to the questions that these patients and that New Brunswickers have.
Moncton neurologist Dr. Alier Marrero originally identified what he believes to be a new disease. He now says it may affect hundreds of people, and not just in your province, but across multiple provinces. The doctor has also warned some patients' blood work, based on his reviews, have showed elevated levels of compounds found in herbicides, and he believes more testing should be done to rule out environmental toxins. Is what you're proposing, the review that you're proposing, going to explore that specific possibility as well?
Yes, we need to find out what's making New Brunswickers sick. We need to know whether it's environmental, whether it's coming from herbicides, or where it's coming from, period. Because until we know what's making people sick, we can't act against it to prevent more people from getting sick and to save New Brunswickers' lives. So we need to get to the bottom of this.
Our CBC News colleagues have certainly investigated this story over the years. In October 2023, federal microbiologist Michael Coulthard, who was part of the initial provincial investigation, said in an internal email obtained by CBC News that he was, quote, essentially cut off, unquote, from working on the file for reasons he could, quote, only discern to be political, unquote. So he believes something real is going on, as he put it, in New Brunswick. What would you say to New Brunswickers who are skeptical and cynical and believe that politics were at play here, or that there's even some kind of cover-up?
Well, I would tell them I can understand why they feel that way. When you have people like Michael Coulthard expressing those sorts of feelings, like they've been cut off of an investigation, when you have offers of help coming from the federal government that the provincial government rejects, when you have a government that isn't willing to act, when more and more and more New Brunswickers are finding themselves sick and some were dying, I can understand the cynicism and the skepticism that anything's going to change and that there isn't politics at the base of all of this. And so we want to reassure those folks that we are taking this exceptionally seriously, and we want to get to the bottom of this illness and what is making New Brunswickers sick.
Some patients and their families, you may have seen, have said or heard, they've said that they have no confidence in New Brunswick's acting chief medical officer of health, Dr. Yves Leger, to lead this investigation. They want the Public Health Agency of Canada to take over entirely. I know you've discussed being open to federal assistance, and that $5 million offer is still on the table from the feds, as I understand it. But do you stand by Dr. Leger in particular and his ability to lead this investigation?
Yes, I think Dr. Leger was acting under difficult circumstances in the past where he didn't have support from the previous government to further an investigation or to take up the offers of help that were there. And so I have confidence that with him and with the federal government's help through the Public Health Agency of Canada, through the Canadian Institute for Health Research, we need all hands on deck. And that includes Dr. Leger's team, who understand New Brunswick and New Brunswickers and who already have a familiarity with some of this data and these cases. We need all hands on deck to try to get answers for New Brunswickers as quickly as possible.
Our listeners heard in the introduction some of the symptoms, and there is quite a range of symptoms. It's quite debilitating for people who develop this. How have you seen these symptoms, this mystery illness, impact people in New Brunswick?
Well, I mean, it's impacted a lot of people and in different ways, but it often seems like it's come out of nowhere. I think about a young woman up in the peninsula, the Acadian Peninsula, who, you know, was in full health, fully capable of having an active life, and then slowly started to lose her ability to think clearly, her energy, her ability to come into work. I think about a woman outside of Moncton whose mother was getting more and more frail, losing the ability to feed herself, and she had to watch her mother die and with no explanation, right? No explanation of how to treat it or what was causing it. It's really scary and it's really painful, and there's not a lot of answers because it's impacting women and men, young people and older people. It's impacting people in particular geographies, and we don't have answers. And so there's a lot of people who are really scared, and a lot of people who are struggling with this disease with no sense of hope of how it could be treated or what the path forward is. So it's really tough for the New Brunswickers and their loved ones that are going through this.
Are you worried, Premier, that you're promising ultimately something that you cannot deliver?
I am scared that we won't be able to deliver answers, but we will do everything we can to do the work to get the answers, to ask the questions, to do the investigation, to gather the data, to talk to the patients and their families, to go out into the field, to try to do everything we can to prevent any other New Brunswickers from getting sick.
Premier Holt, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
Susan Holt is the Premier of New Brunswick. We reached her in Fredericton. Lane Sutterby knows what makes a good death stare. That stare is an S-T-A-I-R. In 2020, Mr. Sutterby created a Facebook page for his friends to share photos of stairwells that they'd come across that were particularly sketchy. The page is called Death Stairs, and its tagline is, "Where ascension is perilous and descending is deadly." That page has now ascended well beyond his friend group and has hundreds of thousands of loyal followers around the world. We reach Lane Sutterby in Newton, Kansas.
Lane, you're an expert by now. So what is the list of criteria? What are the qualities that make a true death stare?
Well, primarily has to be at least sketchy looking, if not actually sketchy. Has to be either ridiculously steep, step treads ridiculously shallow, has to be somewhere where it's either a terrain issue that would make it, you know, terrifying to walk up or down, slippery steps, something like that. There's a handful of things that make a good sketchy death stare.
Have you fallen down a lot of stairs, or do you love, you know, the engineering of staircases? Like, what what brought you to the moment where you thought, I'm going to create this page?
Well, I've had my fair share of slips down staircases.
Me too.
In fact, just here the other day in my own house. But just ironically, they're not sketchy at all. So I don't know how that happened. But I suppose it started, the group started as a tag group. For example, when you come across a picture of something on Facebook, say it's a picture of a poorly engineered bedroom, there's a group called That's It, I'm Architecture Shaming, and you would you just tag that group's name in the comment section under that right. picture. And so that's what it started as. It was just a, you know, something for fun to get a few laughs. I figured, you know, maybe a few of my friends and a handful of strangers would join the group thinking it was amusing. And then here we are, 838,000 members later.
How many?
I think we just crested 838.
838. Everybody has a yeah. staircase story. What a universally painful and funny theme. But the photos people have shared, I've been looking through some of them. What are some of the sketchiest ones, if we could say, that you've seen?
Well, I mean, there's a bunch, but some of my favorites are like ship stairs, where they're either going up to an attic or something, and they're just, it's basically a ladder with slightly deeper steps instead of rungs.
Yeah.
I always love the cross tread, I guess you'd call them, where it's obvious where you're supposed to put one foot and then the other on the next step, but I feel like I'd get mixed up real easy.
Yeah. I mean, I've stood at the top of stairs that are very steep and sketchy, and you talk to yourself, like, okay, be careful, or I'm going to fall. Yeah. And then it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And
have to give yourself a pep talk to get up and down.
But steepness, so clearly steepness is a factor. But there were others where it was just, you know, the carpet is a crazy pattern, and the spacing is extreme or erratic. You know, there are layers to this.
Absolutely, yeah. Some of my favorites, probably, honestly, are the ones where the carpet or the tread pattern, whatever it is, blends into the next steps down, and then at the base it blends in. And so if you look at it from just the right angle, you can't even tell there's steps there until you're face first at the bottom of them.
Have you had instances where people, you know, there's a camaraderie, they see a picture and know exactly where that is because they have taken a dive down those steps?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. For some reason, middle of, I guess it was late last year, we started seeing a massive influx of people from the city of Pittsburgh. And it was just, you know, picture after picture of people posting stairs and everybody else recognizing them. Hey, I fell down those once.
And I can hear Montrealers here in Canada shouting at their radios right now, or looking at the very precarious, you know, iron staircases. They're beautiful to look at, and they're really part of the city, right? The beauty of the city. But they twist and turn. They climb up apartment buildings. They're usually covered, at least in the winter, in ice and snow. So precarious seems like an understatement, actually. But have you seen, have people submitted from Montreal?
I think there's been a few. Yeah. We get so many posts a day that it's honestly hard to keep track of. So,
yeah. One of the rules on your site, be polite. This is just a page about stairs. I mean, are things getting intense in the pursuit of death stairs?
They can, yeah. Really? Some people get pretty heated. That rule primarily is in place because, well, just this morning, for example, we had a post that the comment section turned rather political for some reason. So we're trying to get people to, you know, stay on topic. This is just a page about stairs. We don't care if you like, you know, blue or red. It's stairs. Try not to make it something that ain't.
Well, good advice, Lane. Be careful out there.
Absolutely. You too.
Take care.
Thank you.
Lane Sutterby is the creator of the Death Stairs Facebook page. We reached him in Newton, Kansas. It started as a kind of slurry, and it ended as a... Did you not like the way I said that?
And it's a good way to say that.
It ended as a, quote, lobe-like slice, rich and sensuous, but wholly its own, barely tethered to any previous experience, unquote. At least that's according to Washington Post food reporter Tim Carman, who took part in what may well have been the first public guilt-free tasting of foie gras. Guilt-free because, unlike traditional foie gras, no waterfowl were harmed in the production of that sliver of fatty liver. Also, it's not an actual liver. It was grown in a lab from quail cells. Now, most lab-grown meat companies are placing their bets on your chickens and your beeves. But Vow, the Australian company behind the faux gras, is targeting the high-end market. Forged gras, as they have branded it, which is not as good as faux gras, no offense, is about to hit the market in Singapore and Hong Kong. Australia will be next, and the company already has its lab-grown eyes on North America, where it sees an advantage in the fact that so few people have ever tasted the real thing. I guess when it comes to alternative meats, it's a bonus not to have a taste for the original. Although Mr. Carman does, and he pointed out to Vow's CEO that his product, while buttery and umami-packed, wasn't livery, tasting more like foraged mushrooms than actual foie gras, which apparently pleased the CEO mightily. He wants you to know it's not really a bird's internal organ. In other words, it's not awful. Here's Sean Mendez with Particular Taste.
She don't listen to a thing, unless it feels right. Only dances when it's Kanye. She could take you one-on-one if she feels like. You'll be begging her for mercy.
Mercy.
Ooh, she'll take your name and number, then she'll hit erase and walk away. But ooh, she's so specific when she's at my place. At my place, she's got particular taste.
Yeah.
She's so obsessed with the chase.
Yeah.
She don't waste time on conversations. No, she just goes right for the face.
Yeah.
She's so particular. Never picking up a phone unless it rings twice. Only answers with a question. And if I try to play it cool, it never goes right. Got me drowning, drowning. Ooh, she'll take your name and number, then she'll hit erase and walk away. But ooh, she's so specific when she's at my place. At my place, she's got particular taste.
Yeah.
She's so obsessed with the chase.
Yeah.
She don't waste time on conversations. No, she just goes right for the face. She just goes, she's so particular. I'm so obsessed with her.
Sean Mendez with Particular Taste.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, New York City is set to get a congestion tax. Our guest says she's sure New Yorkers will complain, which seems like a fair prediction, but she's also sure they'll get used to it and maybe even come to appreciate it.
And in the doghouse, a Nova Scotia woman is shocked to discover that her dog sitter filmed erotica in her home, which she realized when she recognized her own swimming pool in an ad for OnlyFans.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
I'm so obsessed with her.
Yeah.
She's so particular. She just goes, she's so particular. She just goes,
yeah.
She's got particular taste.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, DJ Dang, your host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. We receive support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative serving more than 44,000 members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. And we thank the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, welcoming Dr. Carlisle to their team, offering lid and cataract surgery, general eye exams, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Slight chance of snow overnight, lows in the mid to upper 20s, and about a 40% chance of snow tomorrow. Accumulations less than an inch, highs in the low 30s, gusty west winds up to 25 miles per hour. Snow could continue into the evening and lows in the mid 20s. For Thursday, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 30s and breezy northwest winds. There's more ahead from As It Happens.
The push is on to reform global climate talks. COP29, the annual global climate summit, is currently underway in Azerbaijan. The big question, as always at this point in the summit, is whether the assembled nations and corporations can agree on a next step in the fight against climate change. But a group of global mucky mucks, including former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, have written a letter calling for a rethink of how the global fight against climate change works. They want the COP process to focus less on negotiation and more on implementation. And the first thing on their to-do list, making sure climate summits are hosted by countries that are actually committed to fighting climate change. Jayati Ghosh is one of the signatories. She taught development economics in New Delhi for decades before joining the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We reached her in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Professor, I'm wondering, was there a moment or a headline or something you heard? What was it that made you decide to sign this letter?
It wasn't a headline. It was a feeling that several of us have had for a while now, that this whole process, the COP process, is going nowhere. And it had a lot of potential. And the Paris Agreement was a huge breakthrough, and we all hoped that this would actually reflect, especially now when things are so urgent. But what we found is that these COPs have become meaningless rituals which don't actually deliver anything. And the problems are too urgent and intense for us to keep doing these big summits that don't deliver.
One of the things I took from looking at the letter that you've signed on to, you're saying, you and the others are saying, that it's not time to debate and negotiate anymore. It's time to actually implement things. Why is it still at the negotiation phase?
You know, the problem really is that countries come and make these commitments far into the future. So they say by 2050 or 2070. And that lets them off because they're not really promising that I will do the following things in the next couple of years. So what we really need is actionable promises saying, here are the steps I'm going to take next year, the year after that. And then you come back and say, well, I took those steps or I didn't take those steps for the following reasons. There's no accountability. There's no real roadmap that tells us exactly how we're going to proceed. So we have to move towards more frequent summits with smaller, not, you know, lots and lots of these private jets arriving with fossil fuel companies trying to do their side deals. But we need smaller events that are actually focused on clear promises that will be met.
In a world, you know, in the current world we live in and what you've seen over the decades, but also a world where the United States has just had a seminal election, Donald Trump has been reelected. We know what he said on this issue in the past. Is there enough agreement to actually work and deliver the kind of implementation you're talking about? And that's just one country, obviously.
Yes, you know, in fact, I've just written an article about this. I think we're overplaying this. Of course, it's bad. It's very bad for the planet. It's bad for climate. I think it's bad for the U.S. But the problem is that the U.S. has never really been the best faith negotiator in the climate process. Remember, the U.S. is now the world's largest fossil fuel producer. It's a net fossil fuel exporter. And its activities in these negotiations, even under different Democrat administrations, has not necessarily been in the multilateral interest. It's been in its own national interest.
So this is nothing new in your view.
I'm saying that, you know, even the Biden administration coming back into the whole Paris Agreement and so on, it didn't mean that the U.S. activities on fossil fuel changed a lot. So I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. I think what really matters is how the rest of the world responds.
The letter's very first recommendation is about the countries allowed to preside over the COP process. Is that directed at one country in particular, the current host, Azerbaijan, perhaps, where, you know, our listeners heard earlier on in the summit that the president opened COP29 by describing oil and gas reserves as a gift from God? I mean, that country relies on that. So was that recommendation targeting Azerbaijan in particular?
Not necessarily only Azerbaijan. We've had a series of these COPs now, which is based in fossil fuel countries, right? And it's open knowledge now that these have become venues for all the fossil fuel companies to do these side deals.
What do you say, though, Professor, to those who argue that the climate process needs to include everyone, even if people who are at COP don't agree with the leadership and the policies of the countries that the summits are being held in, that it needs to be inclusive, everyone needs to be on board in order for this to actually work?
Oh, I agree. I think everybody has to be on board. But I think what's happened now is that these have become performative summits rather than genuine attempts to change. So what we're saying is that if you want to be part of this, prove that you are actually going to be doing something. And I have a feeling that, you know, history is really on the side of those who are demanding change. And we are already seeing, I mean, the energy transition is ongoing. China and other countries are going ahead with it. More and more countries are going to recognize that this is the future. And for all you know, even the Trump administration, even when it's fixated on getting deals, may realize that it can't afford to be left behind.
Do I hear optimism in that? I mean, it's a bit of a juxtaposition next to what you were saying about your concerns about the summit. You know, use the word meaningless,
yes,
and performative, but I think I heard optimism there.
That's right. I think there is optimism because I believe that the ultimate thrust has got to be towards a just green energy transition. It's not going to happen easily. I think there are huge vested interests against it. But on the other hand, it is happening. So despite the fact that these are performative summits, despite the fact that these are just now literally meaningless rituals and developing countries are not getting the finance and the technology that they need for their transition, there is a kind of momentum that is going to be hard to ignore in the future.
You're a veteran of multiple United Nations and other global bodies. You're a professor, as we've said. You know, I wonder when people hear that you say these summits don't really matter, people at home listening who might already be tuning out anyway, what do you want them to take away from our conversation?
I'm saying that these summits, the fact that they don't matter is a tragedy. We have to make them matter. And the only way we can do that is by putting pressure on our own governments to force them to make commitments that are accountable and to deliver on those promises. So we are allowing these summits to become meaningless. It's up to people to force the transformation.
Professor, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jayati Ghosh is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We reached her in Northampton, Massachusetts. When Amanda Jodry LeBlanc hired someone to look after her dogs, she did not expect her home to be used for adult-only content. So when she saw a TikTok ad for the website OnlyFans and recognized her bathroom and swimming pool, she was, let's say, surprised. The content has now been taken down, but Ms. Jodry LeBlanc told CBC Halifax that she still can't believe it happened to begin with.
I don't even remember how it all sort of, it was a couple of weeks ago and everything sort of all just came at once. A TikTok account was public and there were some spicy content there. with hashtags to other spicy pages. A bunch of people all at the same time, it was within days, had found this had come up on their For You page or whatever, and scrolled and then looked at the hashtags and looked up the names and that, and got contacted and, is that not your house? Is that not your pool? And I'm like, yep, it is. And this was all public. It was publicly available. I was speechless for days and sort of paced around, not sure what to do or how to handle the situation. I'm a major germaphobe. So like when I stay at hotels, I always have my big Lysol can and I Lysol everything before I even go in the room. Like that's just who I am. So I just was in a bit of shock. So when I found out, I reached out to them and I said I wanted all content removed, the explicit videos, photos, and also anything that my dogs were used to promote the business, because I didn't want to be associated anymore. I had recommended this business a lot and I just was completely mortified by the whole thing. In this day and age, regardless of who you have coming in your house for whatever reason, like whether it's a housekeeper or, you know, even keeping your children, this is, I guess, something we have to be mindful of nowadays, that, you know, are you going to be creating content, you know? It's one thing to be asked, and I would have absolutely said no, but I should have, everyone should be given the option to say yes or no, as far as I'm concerned. It's not like this person rented an Airbnb and had control of the place. Like, this person was paid to do a job in people's homes that we trust them to be in and trust them to respect our homes and trust them to respect our privacy, etc. And so it just feels kind of, for lack of a better term, violating. You know, everyone can do whatever they want. I don't care. People have to make money. People like to do that. Good on them. That's on you. I just don't want it done in my home.
That was Amanda Jodry LeBlanc talking to Selena Alders of CBC Halifax. It looks like Manhattan will be getting a congestion charge after all. The new tax on drivers was originally set to start in June, before New York Governor Kathy Hochul called it down, saying it would be too expensive. But this week, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority Board approved a revised plan that brings the cost for most drivers down from $15 to $9. The toll is set to be implemented in January, right before a prominent New Yorker returns to the White House. Tiffany Ann Taylor is the Vice President for Transportation at the Regional Plan Association, a local nonprofit group that supports congestion pricing. We reached her in New York.
Tiffany Ann, the U.S. President-elect has promised in the past to kill congestion pricing during his first week in office. Even with this decision from New York's governor, does that fact worry you?
No, it doesn't worry me as much, I think, as one would expect. Folks have to remember that the congestion pricing policy is being implemented based on law. This is as a result of the 2019 Traffic Mobility Act that was passed for New York State back then. And so the program being implemented is really just carrying out the letter of the law.
It's not the $15 that was initially discussed. It's $9. Does that worry you? That's a big difference.
It is a bit different, but you know what? I think if we had started out in the beginning, perhaps, and said $9, we would still be supportive because it is an additional charge. At the end of the day, even though it is less, it is still dedicated and what will be predictable revenue for the MTA's capital program. And that's something that we desperately need. And I think this also sets a precedent that we can look to have creative ideas, you know, to solve longstanding problems. And that longstanding problem was finding dedicated funding for the MTA.
It certainly is not a done deal, as you know. New Jersey's Governor Phil Murphy is opposed to this, is fighting this in court. The New York Trucking Association is fighting this in court as well. So, you know, let's talk about the amount of the fee, first of all. Is decreasing it to $9 going to be enough to assuage the concerns of commuters in particular who are concerned about affordability?
I can hope that that is the case. I do want to remind your listeners that the idea is that it will be phased, reaching $15 over time. So the $9 is to start, and I think it's exactly as you've described, to get folks comfortable with the idea of paying an additional fee, and then having folks decide if they want to, you know, make a trip via public transportation instead, or be willing to pay that additional cost. And then over time, we will start to see that the charge will make its way up to $15.
And what about, you know, trucking companies, smaller ones in particular? So they're saying, you know, it would be about $20 per trip in and out of the city, and that could add up for a smaller company, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, to be clear, the $9 that we were talking about previously is really for passenger vehicles. Yeah. And you're correct in that for commercial vehicles, it is higher. I would want to say that there are additional benefits to the smaller and mid-sized businesses as well as part of the program. There still is a 75% reduction in the toll charge and the overnight hours that existed under the $15 plan and still exists under the $9 plan. So if there's an opportunity to switch to off-peak delivery, they'll save money there. There is money as part of the mitigation package for congestion pricing to incentivize businesses to participate in that off-hours program. There's also additional money going to the New York City Clean Trucks Program, which is a program that helps fleets change over to hybrid or electric vehicles and hopes that, you know, they'll save money over time in terms of maintenance and additional costs from using trucks fueled by fossil fuels like gas. And then also there is a direct benefit to their employees. If employees of these businesses are using public transportation to get to their jobs, they will see, you know, improved service on public transportation. And then lastly, there will be less congestion in the streets, and hopefully that means more efficient business is being done during the peak hours, which is an overall benefit for all business.
You mentioned, you know, that this money will help the MTA. Where will people see that money, you know, on the trains or their commute?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a bunch of places. So one is the upgrade to the signaling system called CBTC. And that's a system that helps figure out where the trains are, makes them run more efficiently so that, you know, folks can get on their way much faster and much safer. Also, more money towards station improvements that are, you know, capital of construction related. Only about a quarter of our subway system is ADA accessible, so money from congestion pricing will go towards making those types of improvements. The MTA will also be able to buy more hybrid and electric buses and also be able to retrofit corresponding bus depots to be able to run maintenance on said buses. And so those are a few things that folks will be able to both see and feel as a benefit to the congestion pricing charge.
So we'll see if that gets New Yorkers on board, so to speak. But I wonder, you know, that lack of congestion, the New York that you were describing when this comes into play is not a New York that even non-New Yorkers can envision. Do you think New Yorkers are going to get used to this kind of tax and that they will, you know, agree with it and be pleased in the end?
I think so. I think when things are new for the first time, they're uncomfortable, they're unfamiliar. But I want to remind your listeners that we've done new and uncomfortable things in the past. There was a time where there was a fight, right, over pedestrian plazas being created in Times Square. And now it's something that folks are really excited about and has been replicated across the city and other parts of the country. More recently, the Brooklyn Bridge has been retrofitted to take away a lane of traffic heading into Manhattan. And that has been completely repurposed for a dedicated and protected bike lane as well. And that has been proven to be really successful and has allowed folks to make a safer commute and allowed pedestrians to travel safely by walking across the bridge in their dedicated space. Those are just a couple of examples of things that felt new or were scary or perhaps uncomfortable and that we've grown to love as a city.
I bet you there's still some New Yorkers complaining about all of those things you mentioned.
Yes.
Or is that just part of the ethos of being a city dweller?
I think so. I think also New Yorkers love to complain. You know, even if it's sunny, somebody's complaining that the sun is shining too bright. What are you going to do?
Tiffany Ann, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
No problem. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Tiffany Ann Taylor is the Vice President for Transportation at the Regional Plan Association. We reached her in New York. Last week, the Hamilton band The Arkells posted a video from their show in Kelowna. The text on the screen reads, "We saw this kid in the crowd air drumming, so we brought her up." And behind that text, you see a young woman run on stage and grab the drumsticks. And the audio sounds like this.
And we'd like to welcome... Come on, come on. Introduce yourself.
My name is Ainsley.
From a video of the Calgary drummer Ainsley Frasca dropping in behind the drum kit with the Arkells last week in Kelowna. And the thing you need to know about Ainsley is that, as that text on the video puts it, she's 15 years old with three deserved exclamation marks. Here's Ainsley explaining how that came about.
So it kind of started in their Calgary show, which was about a week before, where I had this amazing opportunity to meet them before their show. And we kind of got to just jam out a little bit. So they had kind of seen me play and they had met me already. And then we went out to Kelowna to see another one of their shows because my mom and I love them. And our birthdays are coming up soon. So it was like a little trip. And when we were there, we had floor tickets and we were right up by the front. And after they played their song, "Oh, the Boss is Coming," which is the one that was in the clip, the singer pointed at me and asked me if I wanted to play the drums with them on that one for the last chorus.
Oh, wow. So what was that like? Were you like, by the way, I mean, you crush the performance. You're a fantastic drummer. So let's establish that. What was the sort of personal experience of that like for you to play in front of that many people with that band and rock that hard?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much. That's very kind. That experience was like, it sounds very cliche, but it was like, kind of like, it felt like slow motion. Like I felt like everything I was doing was taking much longer than it was. And I have played with bands before. So I have a lot better handle on my, you know, stage nerves and stage fright than some other people might. So I just kind of went up there and I was like, well, this is happening. I've got my chance. So there's no room for error here. Like I just kind of have to go. And it was incredible. It felt like I was like floating afterwards. I was like just super, had a big adrenaline rush. And it was so exciting.
15-year-old Calgary drummer Ainsley Frasca speaking with Lauren McGinnis on the Calgary Eye Opener this morning.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.